This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why, for there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The time and tears went by.
Good evening. The title of this installment is Anti-White Identity. It's an extension, really, of last week's installment on identity politics. I think I bit off more than I could chew there and tried to fit too much into one episode, and I want to flesh out what I discussed there. I have some feedback that I got from some friends, some listeners, about not just the previous installment, but the one before that as well. And I'd like to address some of that feedback. The first point was a friend who said, was made by a friend who said that there are modern nuances to the meaning of ethnicity and nation and race. And he got the impression that I was trying to say that they were all the same. And he pointed out that these terms have grown to include additional meanings beyond their ancient meanings that I discussed. And I acknowledge this. It's true. I didn't mean to make that impression that I thought that they were all identical. The point I wanted to make is that they're all related to each other and racial in nature, biological in nature. He went on to say that by your sharp line definitions, Jews are a nation, but whites, blacks, Asians, and Hispanics can never be a nation because they do not spontaneously share, quote, common language, culture, ethnicity, descent, or history, unquote. So as I say, I didn't want to leave the impression that that there was a sharp line definition for any of these words. I wanted to clarify what the definition is. I have an answer for that point there about who is and isn't a nation, and I'll get to that in just a second when I try to flesh out these ideas a bit and restate my point. As I say, that these concepts are all related and biologically rooted, and the meanings have shifted over time. I made a point of saying that. And the most important shift, the one that concerns me the most, and that I think is the most that any white person should be concerned about, is the relatively recent shift due to Marxist influence that has distorted the meaning of the word nation, removing the racial sense from it, removing the biological roots of that word, and changing it into just a synonym for country. And that was triggered by this idea of deracinated nationalism, which I thought was absurd, and tried to point out why I think it's absurd. I think that the purpose behind, you know, for Marxists distorting the meaning of nation is that they wanted to hijack it and repurpose it. It is a useful concept, and it had a long-standing history behind it, and they wanted to use it to help validate multiracialism, to help justify yoking several nations together to create larger conglomerations that would make them more powerful, the people who run those conglomerations. We see it also in the terms of proposition nation and nation of immigrants, that this whole idea of nation distorted in that way is really just used to justify throwing every which kind of people no matter how different they are, together in a country, and telling them they're all citizens of the same country and they all have something that they share and that they have common cause with each other, when they really don't, and they don't feel it instinctually, and it doesn't work. Well, anyway, the main point that I wanted to make was that ethnic and national identities are essentially racial in nature, and even clan and tribal identities too. And in fact, I started off by saying that there is a continuum, a spectrum of sociobiological identity, from self to family to clan to tribe, ethne, nation, race, and humankind as a whole, with each of those stages being like layers of an onion. I know I'm repeating myself, but it's worth it, I think. From fine-grained to coarse-grained, from tightly genetically related to each other, from the self and the family, to the more loosely related race and humankind, and everything in between, and that it's a progression there. And I don't think I said it, but I'll say it now, that these things blend and they overlap somewhat, even now, at this point in time. So to answer this point about, are Jews a nation, whites, blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and so forth, since Herodotus 2,500 years ago until the early 20th century, race and nation and ethne were all nearly synonymous. And it changed a little bit. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but concepts like black and white and Asian and Hispanic are more continental groupings, or at least white, black, and Asian, or yellow. I guess it's less commonly called yellow, but and I'm using American terms here for white, black, and Asian. But white corresponds pretty much to European, black corresponds to African, and yellow corresponds to Asian. Hispanic, roughly, Hispanics can argue with Latinos about who's who and how much European is in there, but it's that's a whole other ball of wax. It's not really equivalent to white or black or Asian. But there's a strong component of Amerindian in there, and the red man, mestizo. Some of them call themselves bronze, the bronze race. A point I could make about this is that this became significant only during and after the Age of Discovery, when Europeans went out and explored the entire world and came into contact with non-Europeans. And that's the point at which white really came to be understood as important relative to these other more alien people. Before that, it was really just the races of Europe and the races of the various regions of the globe that were in contact with each other and seeing each other in contrast with each other. But I'll get more into that in future installments when I talk about white identity in particular. And Jews, too. That's another one for a future installment. So another friend provided me with another bit of feedback, criticism, really, harsher criticism, saying that all this stuff about Marxism, like bourgeois nationalism, was too esoteric, tedious, and boring, and wanted to know, when am I going to get to white identity? Well, I've been talking about white identity in bits and pieces all along here. From the very beginning of this series, I've started out taking it for granted, but offering bits and pieces. I will talk about it probably in the next installment more directly. But I do think that this is important. A basic principle that I believe is true is that it's not a good idea to ignore reality. We can't ignore that deracinated nationalism in reality is a dystopian nightmare of interracial strife, that it's bad for whites. And I don't think we can ignore that the definition of identity and identity politics is intentionally, deliberately anti-white. And the divide and conquer came up in the last installment, and it was in the definition of bourgeois nationalism that came up. And I'm glad that I read that little section, because this is important. This is the dishonesty that I'm getting at in how this identity is described in the mainstream, how it's taught in the universities to our children, is it's a Marxist idea, which is a lie, that the elites are trying to divide and conquer us by creating these fake identities, these fake racial identities, that race is a social construct and it's used to put us at each other's throats. And it's all to cover up the real division, which is a class and a money-based or material division. And I think it's alive. I think that the primary division is racial. It's ethnic. It's national. And that that the Marxist ideology is really what's being used to divide and conquer us. So the first person, the first friend that gave me the feedback about my definitions being a little bit too narrow, said that this Marxist view actually kind of appealed to him. He saw the sense in it. I see a bit of a sense in it too. I didn't deny that class and materialism economics is important. I just say that, you know, the priorities are not, that it's not the only thing that's important. And you know, the basic idea that he was trying to express was, and this is the same person who suggested that he was a deracinated nationalist to begin with, is, you know, can't we just all get along? He'd like us to not necessarily sing Kumbaya. He's often criticizes that attitude, but would like to just, you know, come to some accommodation with his non-white neighbors and not have to deport them. And I say the short answer to that, can't we all just get along, is no, we can't. That's just the fact. Whites have tried to get along, and it's not working. The elite, I'll make this point too, the elite is heavily Jewish. They haven't abandoned their group identity. They unashamedly pursue the best interests of their group. And in the face of deracinated opponents or partners who think in their head, can't we all just get along? They don't just get along, these Jews in the elites. They get ahead, and they use that power when they get ahead to shape our culture and to define our culture, to alter our morals and our values. It's in a way that's helpful to themselves, probably is what they think they're doing. But in effect, it's harmful to whites. That's what I think as a white person. And they pathologize and demonize. One of the harmful things that's clear is they pathologize and demonize white identity. And that's bad for whites. So to my second friend and the point about this being boring, too bad. This postmodernist mumbo jumbo that they use in social sciences, like identity politics, is intended to make your eyes glaze over. It's deceptive. It's disguising doublethink, and it's intended to bore you or to confuse you, because it's biased against whites, and they are using this dishonest language that makes it sound like it's all general and universal, but it's not. And I want to complete the section I was reading last installment because it I think makes that clear, and I had to rush and cut it off last time, so I want to finish that. But first I want to say, you know, this Marxist Frankfurt School critical theory stuff is critical of Europeans. It's aimed at Europeans. It's not aimed at Asians. It's not aimed at Africans. It's not aimed at everybody. It could be dressed up so that it sounds like it might, and that's my point, is that sometimes it is, but it's, and maybe it will be generalized finally to Asians and Africans when European society is completely in ruins. But I'd like to stop it before it gets to that point. I'd like to see it stopped. I'd like white people to take action to stop it. So the piece that I was reading last week that I would like to continue here is this liberalism and identity politics section from a page called Identity Politics from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And the first paragraph was, critics charged that the neutral citizen of liberal theory was in fact the bearer of an identity, coded white, male, bourgeois, able-bodied, and heterosexual. This implicit ontology in part explained the persistent historical failure of liberal democracies to achieve anything more than even token inclusion in power structures for members of marginalized groups. That's some of the postmodernist mumbo jumbo there, this fancy words like ontology and marginalized groups and liberal democracies. There's a lot of meaning packed in there. But the important section is this idea that identity, that the criticism here of liberal theory is that it's somehow secretly coded to benefit white, male, bourgeois, able-bodied, heterosexual people. So, you know, in a nutshell, what's wrong with this liberal theory? What's their critique of it? Whiteness, that's what's wrong with it. The next paragraph is, a richer understanding of political subjects as constituted through and by their social location was required. In particular, the history and experience of oppression brought with it certain perspectives and needs that could not be assimilated through existing liberal structures. Individuals are oppressed by virtue of their membership in a particular social group, that is, a collective whose members have relatively little mobility into or out of that collective, who usually experience their membership as involuntary, who are generally identified as members by others, and whose opportunities are deeply shaped by the relation of their group to corollary groups through privilege and oppression. Now, I say there that they're talking about, this is where the oppression comes from that I mentioned last installment. They're defining implicitly white people as the oppressors. They're using very general terms, and they don't identify the oppressed groups as non-white in this paragraph. We'll get to that. But I want to point out here that this business about, you know, the membership in a group is involuntary. Well, to a certain extent, being white is involuntary too. When you're being lectured about being white and being an oppressor, you know, you're being told who you are by these people in the universities and in government. You know, whether you choose to be white or not, you're told you have white privilege. The language of inclusion, oppression, and oppression, we'll get into this when I talk about Jewish identity, but I'll point out here that this is a Jewish perspective on things, that they're the ones who divide the world into two classes, the oppressors and the oppressed, and of course they're members of the oppressed class. And my argument is that the oppressors are white and the oppressed are the non-white. This is meant, this critique here of identity and liberalism is meant as an indictment of whites. And, you know, our guilt is mandatory, and we have no mobility away from our identity, which is, you know, ironic. The terms that they're trying to use here, they're trying to associate that with the oppressed people, the non-whites. But you could see it, if you really were being fair, you could see it cutting in the favor of whites too, as I do. The next paragraph is, oppression then is the systematic limiting of opportunity or constraints on self-determination because of such membership. As I say, it applies to whites too. Whites are constrained as to how they can self-determine. We're told we can't even have an identity. We're not allowed to have nationalism. That's a bad thing. That's far right neo-Nazi idea. It's bad for everybody. So we shouldn't do it. For example, and here's the example that they use, though, is a white example. Franz Fanon eloquently describes the experience of being always constrained by the white gaze as a black man. So this is a black fellow saying this. I already knew that there were legends, stories, history, and above all, historiosity. I was responsible at the same time for my body, my race, for my ancestors. Conversely, members of dominant groups are privileged, systematically advantaged by the deprivations imposed on the oppressed. For example, in a widely cited article, Peggy McIntosh identifies whiteness as a dominant identity and lists 47 ways in which she is advantaged by being white compared with her colleagues of color. These range from being able to buy flesh-colored Band-Aids that will match her skin tone, to knowing that she can be rude without provoking negative judgments on her racial group, to being able to buy a house in a middle-class community without risking neighbors' disapproval. Here it is. This paragraph, this is the money paragraph. It really makes it clear that we're not. This is not a general critique of advantaged groups versus disadvantaged groups. This is a critique of whites. And in contrast to non-whites. And it's whites who are the dominant group and the privileged group, regardless, really, of the situation. It's just assumed. I mean, silly things like being able to buy flesh-colored Band-Aids is a sign of our oppression, that we are oppressors. It's unbelievable. There it is. And the final paragraph that I want to read from this thing, there's plenty more in this. I just pulled out this stuff because it talks about oppression and whites. Here's the final paragraph. Critics have also charged that assimilation, or less provocatively, integration, is a guiding principle of liberalism. If the liberal subject is coded in the way Young suggests, then attempts to apply liberal norms of equality will risk demanding that the marginalized conform to the identities of their oppressors. And this is what prompted me last installment to summarize this whole reading here as a critique of whites, that whites in the old days were not inclusive enough, and that was oppression, that today whites are too inclusive, and that's oppression. In that last paragraph, we see that. And that the one constant here is that whites are oppressors. I don't think I'm being paranoid to read that into this, and I could go find more examples than this if I, you know, wanted to risk boring all of my listeners with it. But I think the point is made now, and I don't need to drive it home any further. I talked about last time another thing I wanted to fill in here, because when I listened to it myself, I could see I had missed some points. I asked the rhetorical question last time, who rules? Who is the ruling class? And you're talking about privilege. Whose privilege is it to not be criticized in our society today? I talked about the chattering classes, and I mentioned the elected leaders and the talking heads, and I specifically focused on television. But I completely overlooked mentioning the plutocrats, who actually sit atop, who are the new aristocracy in effect, a nameless aristocracy, except for certain people like George Soros and so on. We don't really know who they are, but they, their needs and their demands are come first before any of us ordinary voters in this democracy, which is really a sham. What we have as a political system is more of a plutocracy. And that's worth a whole installment to itself. But I had overlooked that. I want to fill that in. But also another thing I missed was the talking about the Humpty Dumpties who define the words. I mean, it was right there. I was talking about them, but I didn't call them out explicitly, and I want to do that now. The people who write essays like this, articles like this about identity politics and about liberalism and these critiques, these criticizers, these historians, the people who teach in the universities, who teach these ideas, they're part of the chattering classes too. They're part of the ruling class because they define the terms that we think in. and that we talk in and we discuss in, and they define who's allowed to talk and who isn't allowed. And it's coercion. It's not outright forcing us not to talk, but they're working on that. They would like to define everything that they don't want to hear as hate speech and just illegalize it, criminalize it. And that is coming. For now, though, we do have it's only a coercive force that keeps us from talking about this, discourages us from talking about it. But as I've said many times before, language is important. There are two ways to control how people think and what people talk about. And one way is the overt method of illegalizing and criminalizing. But this manipulating the definitions of words and can control thoughts almost as effectively. And using propaganda to change those definitions from the top down is how it's being done to us, with words like nationalism being made into almost a, well, for sure it's a pejorative in today's discourse, political discourse, and races as well. These are bad concepts, and white people specifically are not supposed to identify themselves as nationalists, and certainly not as racialists or racists. That makes you stupid, crazy, and evil. So there's another element that I saw in the installment last time was this sort of conflict, this transition from old school Marxism, which was class warfare based and wants to remain focused on that, to this newer cultural Marxism that comes out of the Frankfurt School, that's relatively recent, and it's identity politics based. And they argue with each other, but even though they argue with each other and disagree with each other, there is a transition here. And identity politics is coming to the forefront now. Now that we have multiracial societies and we have tremendous numbers of non-whites in our society clamoring about their victimhood and wanting payback for their grievances, this identity politics just becomes more and more important. And the fact, it's worth two installments to talk about it, is that it's anti-white. It's defined against whites. Identity politics is for everyone but whites. It defines identity for everyone as being for everyone but whites. It's constructed to divide and conquer as well, to divide and conquer whites. Race is real. It's a biological reality. It has real consequences in the world. And among those consequences are these squabbles over identity, who is us, and politics, what's best for us. And the question, who is us, is best settled before trying to grapple with what's best for us. But the current regime, which is dominated by Jews and others whose highest priority is what's best for the Jews, have forbidden identity politics to whites, and in fact define identity politics in anti-white terms, against whites. Whites are the oppressors. Well, see you next time.